Greetings and welcome to MERS Monday, the official podcast of the MERS Political Newsletter. I'm Kyle Malin, joined by the crew here, Jack, John, Jacob, Simon, and Mike. A little later, John Engler, former governor of the state of Michigan, will be joining us. He's meeting with us in Grand Rapids. But first, guys, let's talk about the what happened with the Democratic Forum this past weekend. Mike, you were there to watch four people who have filed campaign committees with the state to run for governor on the Democratic side. What did you see over at the Avenue Cafe?
We listened to Gretchen Whitmer, Bill Cobbs, retired Xerox executive, Abdul El-Sayed, former health department director from Detroit, and Kentiel White, an EMS driver. And they laid out their progressive credentials. They didn't show a lot of distinction in their positions, but Gretchen Whitmer wanted to make it clear that she has government experience. The other candidates were quite dynamic.
150 people at this event, you would say, at the Avenue Cafe. Did they have to turn anyone out?
No, it was a nice-sized crowd. A little surprising to get that many people on a nice sunny day.
So what do you make out of this, Jack? What's the grabber for you on an event this early in a campaign season?
You know, from my perspective, it's Gretchen Whitmer and then the other three. You get out there and you being seen and so on. But this early, you know, you have a lot more freedom to say what your positions are going to be on things. Although I guess the four of them didn't differ very much on the positions. And it's really presenting yourself as a candidate, and it's being seen and being heard. To me, it's the early stages where you kind of set yourself up and people become familiar with you.
John, April 15 of 2017, and there's already an event for governor. And not only was there an event, there was 150 people there in Lansing.
Well, you know, you shouldn't be surprised, though. I mean, we're looking at the end of a two-term run for the opposite party's candidate as governor. So there's an opening here. People are excited about it. It's the first time in 8 years they've had an open seat to run for. So you can't be too surprised. As far as the event itself, though, it's hard to differentiate between candidates at an event like this because the candidates are going to sing the hymn that the choir likes the best, and that's the progressive hymn. It's the same as if you're covering Republicans in front of a National Rifle Association event. They're all going to sing the same hymn that the NRA wants to hear.
So what's the point of these things from your perspective, Simon? Why have something like this so early when there's not going to be a lot of differentiating?
Well, I think, you know, coming out of the 2016 national presidential election, we saw a Democratic Party that really did not have a strong, unified message that it could use to counter, you know, what Trump used as a very effective conservative response. Of course, the Republican Party is, you know, fractured along its own divisions. But at the same time, the Democrats really need to kind of coalesce around something that they can rally around, and rather than just simply a Trump backlash. I mean, it may have worked well in 2010 for Republicans, but I don't know if that the same sort of success can be repeated.
So, Mike, did you see any folks with cell phone cameras taking good video of this? Because it seems to me like if you're a Republican operative, you got to be at these kind of events to track these folks, see what they have to say, because if they're going to make any kind of blunder, they're going to be making them early on in the campaign as they're trying to win over the largest number of folks possible.
There were cameras recording, and so a lot of the conversation did get on record with somebody, but I can't tell you who all had those cameras.
Was there applause? Did people have any applause during this event?
Oh, sure.
Who got the most applause?
Hard to say. Bill Cobbs got an ovation. Gretchen did it at different times. I think what we heard was what the Democrats are going to make issues in the coming election year. They're going to bring up the environment. They're going to bring up the crisis, the water crisis in Flint. Okay. They're going to bring up the emergency manager law. They want rid of that. They were all singing that same tune.
If you're a Democrat going into this 2018 campaign, what are the issues? Do you focus on Trump or do you focus on Snyder?
I think with Governor Snyder's record, you know, you have a dossier of talking points that's about an inch thick. I think the issue for Republicans is going to be, you know, what are the successes that they can talk about and say that they need to build on, you know, to win an election?
If you're a Democrat running for governor, do you focus on Snyder or do you focus on Trump?
I think it depends. I think this is the problem with doing it so early. You've got a lot of time here left to find out what you should be focusing on. I mean, an awful lot of things are going to happen between now and the election day. You have to be nimble enough to pick up on whatever you can pick up on. I would argue that part of the problem the Democrats may have had in recent elections have been too much of a one big national focus. And when you're getting, you know, all kinds of things that could have been datelined Washington, D.C. or New York, New York, I think that maybe part of the explanation as to why they've done so badly in the midterms.
Let's talk about the personalities in the room. This Kentile White was there by himself, probably the least of the four who made an impression.
Yeah, the much more dynamic speakers were Bill Cobbs, and of course Gretchen Whitmer is a good speaker. She knows how to work a crowd. Abdul El-Sayed, very intelligent man, a doctorate, you'd expect that, I suppose. But I thought they all carried themselves very well and were quite dynamic in their talking.
So Abdul El-Sayed, he's in the midst of his own statewide campaign tour right now, and he's got a crew, and Simon, you've covered him before, so you know he's got an actual campaign apparatus with a campaign manager and the whole bit. He's taken time off his job, and that's what he's doing full time. We know that Gretchen Whitmer is in the same boat. We've talked about her before. Bill Cobbs, it's kind of a one-man gang, right? He doesn't have a team surrounding him. It's not the same type of campaign apparatus.
From what I've been able to see, hadn't asked him specifically about that, but he's getting around. He was at the Nestle hearing in Big Rapids earlier this week, so he's working the state pretty darn hard.
Dan Kildee is not in the race yet, John. What do you make of that? And how long do you think he has before he's got to decide or get in or out?
I really think if you think about it historically, he wants to be active and he wants to be very visible and have the prospect of a candidacy alive when the Mackinac Public Policy Conference for the Detroit Regional Chamber happens. I mean, if you remember, Jennifer Granholm launched her career almost the same span of time before she made her bid for the Attorney General. She became the buzz of that conference. That's really a platform you can start to build. You have to be organized. You've got to be meeting with people. You've got to start building the base of funders and organizing yourself as a candidate. And I think if he waits much past that, you got to question whether or not he's even interested.
What do you think the timeline is for Kildee, Jack? Does he have to get in by Mackinac? It seems like he would have to get some kind of buzz going, or he has to have some presence at Mackinac. He could put himself in a situation where labor unions who are looking to get behind somebody will start tapping their fingers on the table wondering what's going on.
Well, first of all, we're talking about him now, so there is a buzz about him. So there is that kind of a idea that, okay, everybody's waiting to see if this guy gets in. Well, you can kind of play that for a little bit. You get past that Mackinac regional thing on the island, it starts becoming a problem of raising money, of being able to be out there and line things up. So is that the absolute deadline? Probably not. It's getting close, though. I don't think you let that thing, if you're going to jump in, I don't think you let it stew very much longer than beyond that event.
I think I can play devil's advocate here, Kyle, in saying that I think that recent political history has showed us that when you are in a congested primary field where there are quite a number of candidates, that being an establishment figure that's just another face up there on the stage is not necessarily always working to your advantage. And at the same time, too, if you're, you know, attending events that are hosted by progressive caucuses, you don't necessarily want to, you know, be just another face at an agreement fest. So I think by holding out, there may be some advantage in, you know, maybe raising himself above the fray.
Well, in the case of Dan Kildee, it's not as if he's unemployed right now. He is a member of Congress. He is getting on the radio. He is talking with folks on various different things. We just haven't seen him as active as maybe we did at the very beginning of the year. He's slowing down, but maybe that's just because session has started as well. So
his rhetoric, though, has changed, too. I mean, dial back the clock 12 months ago when I interviewed him on Mackinac Island, and he was very much aggressively acting and posturing himself as a candidate. We haven't heard that rhetoric in a long time.
Well, maybe, and I hear what you're saying here, just again to play devil's advocate, maybe because there's more issues on D.C., and maybe it's less about what he is talking about and more about the fact that he's talking.
I mean, if you look at him in comparison to the other candidates, though, Kyle, Gretchen Whitmer is someone who's not afraid to use fiery rhetoric, and the other candidates that were up there on the stage were complete and total outsiders. Dan Kildee is essentially forced into playing an establishment position, and I think that if he wants to be in this thing for the long run, he has to show that, you know, that maybe he's not willing to instead ride a backlash to a current administration or the outgoing Snyder administration, but instead, perhaps play more to the center. And that might work in his favor.
Jacob, what are you thinking about this Democratic gubernatorial primary field, how it's developing or not developing?
Yeah, I'm actually kind of in line with what Simon's thinking. I think we've focused a lot of our discussion with regards to Kildee about this rush to get in early just because Gretchen Whitmer did. And certainly, I think we've seen some of the benefits of that play out. So there could be an advantage, in addition to what Simon said, to wait for Kildee, even beyond Mackinac. I think we can assume that Whitmer will be around. I think she has this the structure in place. But the other three could, eventually pass away. And so I think waiting might give him an opportunity to kind of see where the issues are, where he can position himself in regards to Whitmer. So there could be a rush to get in, but I think there could also be an advantage to waiting and seeing the field shake out a little more here.
I like what you said there, Simon Says. That's almost like its own segment in itself. We should think about that a little bit. The Simon Says segment, yes. Okay, well, John, you were able to catch up with our former governor. Let's go ahead and listen to that interview.
We are pleased to welcome today to the MERS Money Podcast former Governor John Engler. Welcome, Governor.
Well, thank you very much. Good to be with you.
Before I get started with the questioning, I want to just mention for our listeners, on May 10th, you're going to be honored for your contribution to our state's political history and history in general by the Michigan Political History Society. And congratulations on that recognition.
Well, thank you. I think the Michigan Political History Society does a nice job of trying to compile the historical record of Michigan, and they've done a nice job in going back and capturing oral histories of people who've been part of Michigan government, who've made an impact, who've been around and been responsible for some of the policies, some of the decisions that have helped govern Michigan over the years. So when they asked me to come back and to be part of this, and they use this really as a fundraiser to support the work of the History Society, so it's more for them, not for me. I'm happy to come back and be part of it. I know Governor Blanchard's done this previously, and Attorney General Kelly and others. So I think it's important work, and I do think the statement that if you don't learn your history, you're doomed to repeat it is valid today. And in a time when we're plagued with term limits and the tenure of people in office is so short, we've lost a lot of that institutional memory. We've lost a lot of that appreciation for history. Mm-hmm. And so nonprofit groups like the Political History Society serve an important, valid purpose.
We talked a little bit about your transition. You were the head of the National Association of Manufacturers for about 6 years, the Business Roundtable for about 6 years. Is there any plans in terms of, are you planning to stay in D.C.? Will that continue to be the Engler's home? Any plans to maybe spend more time in Michigan or...
Well, you know, we have a place in Shiawassee County that we get to not often enough for both Michelle and my preference. Our daughters are graduating from college this year. That was the anticipated event of 2017. We've been looking forward to the girls completing their undergraduate degrees, and so we have graduations in April, the first one. Hannah graduates from the University of Michigan, and then Madeline from William & Mary, and in May, and then Maggie graduates from Stanford in June, so we have the one each month, and then we're going to take a little family trip, and then they'll start their careers, and their job searches are underway now. But as far as the role I'm going to play, I continue to be active on several boards and taking on projects that are of interest to me. We've spent a little bit more time in San Antonio, where Michelle's parents are. Both of them have had some health issues in the past year. So we're not at all wedded to being in Virginia and being in the D.C. area. And the fact that I don't have to be there for work now gives us a lot of flexibility. It gives us a lot of freedom. And our intention is to try to take advantage of it, but we haven't made any decisions yet.
Any ideas about a next stage in your career, or are you just kind of enjoy some time?
Well, I've been too busy to think about it. So the fact that I'm not going to the roundtable every day doesn't mean that the different activities I'm engaged with, I'm not busy, and it seems like there's been no time hardly to catch one's breath, and I'm looking forward to slow down a little bit, get a little better organized. I've stepped up some of the work I do on some of the boards and taken on committee chairmanships, which I couldn't do in the past because of the full-time work. So both Michelle and I are finding plenty to do and wondering where the time all goes. So we haven't slowed down all that much.
Some Republicans obviously talk about upcoming future races. Would you ever consider running in a future race? If I were a betting man, would there be any odds you'd think about a Senate race maybe in 2 years?
No, there'd be no odds. And I don't know how to make it clear. It's a stupid question. You have to ask it, I suppose. So you get the same answer that everyone else gets. No.
I wanted to talk to you a little bit about your perception of the current administration, obviously in your role at the Business Roundtable at NAM. Export was a very big issue for your members and for your organizations. Do you have any reaction to what's the posture the administration's taken so far?
Well, I think that, clearly it was a disappointment that the Trans-Pacific Partnership negotiations, which had really taken an awfully long time to get to the finish line, aren't now going to be able to go to completion. I think that many of us felt that there were some pretty significant breakthroughs there in terms of protecting intellectual property, protecting some of the capital of the U.S. in terms of its innovativeness and productive abilities. And we were going to open up some markets, drop 18,000 tariffs. And I think that there is a need for rules-based trade out around the world. No question that the president in the campaign, and we had a campaign unusual where the candidates in both parties opposed the Trans-Pacific Partnership. So it was pretty clear that once the nominations were done, that was going to be in trouble and it wasn't going to be able to go forward as it had been negotiated. Part of the problem was that it took too long to negotiate. Trade has been such a difficult issue politically. President Obama really didn't want to touch it in his first 4 years, and he simply ran out of time in the second 4 years. It is also the case that trade largely has been bipartisan. You had the Bush administration, George H.W. Bush, negotiating NAFTA, then President Clinton, after he's elected, seeing through the ratification of it. You had the Caribbean Free Trade Agreement, where the Bush administration had to become involved with that. And then there was the Panama, Colombia, and South Korea negotiations, which had been done toward the end of the Bush time, and then those were done when President Obama took office. So I think that the president has assembled a team of advisors that are very talented. I know Wilbur Ross, he was part of the Business Roundtable. He's a smart man. He's been around international issues, he's been around manufacturing, he's been around trade. There is no question you can update and improve some of the existing agreements, and I think there will be a lot of interest in seeing what the approach will be. We don't have a USTR, that's the trade ambassador. Mm-hmm. USTR stands for United States Trade Representative, but that position, the person's been named but not yet confirmed by the Senate. So a lot of this we don't know yet, but I think that there was some relief on the part of parties in Mexico and in Canada and in the U.S. that the fundamentals of NAFTA are probably going to remain in place and that the effort will be to see how that can be improved. And, while there are improvements the U.S. wants, there's no question that the other sides also want improvements. But I think that when we're less than 5% of the world's population, with our great productive capacity in manufacturing and technology, our ability in agriculture to grow bountiful crops, and we can't consume all of these ourselves. We need someplace to sell. And one of the things that the Trans-Pacific Partnership did was start to open the door a lot more on services, which again is probably an area where the U.S. has some significant advantages if we can penetrate markets around the world. So we're going to be engaged, I think, as a nation. I don't think you can create wealth. I don't think you can lift people out of economic stagnation without a robust trade. approach. There is a rethinking of all kinds of issues now, but bottom line for me has always been, if we can get our GDP growth rate from below 2% back up above 3, 3.5, even 4, you'll start to see a lot more excitement and you'll see a lot more wage growth. The problem we've had is that even though the unemployment rate's gone down and been down for quite some time, we've had an awful lot of people left the workforce, never came back in, and we've had people who've been in the workforce working 2 jobs, 3 jobs, just trying to keep their head above water because the wages have been flat. And so we do need that. We need productivity, but we need economic growth, and trade is a piece of that. It's not the solution by itself, but it's going to be a contributor.
Since we're focusing a little bit on the History Society, I want to ask you a couple of questions important to Michigan's political history. You were rising to power in the state just when term limits were enacted. Think back about what you've seen as far as an observer, as far as a participant. What do you think about term limits today? Has your opinion changed at all?
Well, I wasn't a supporter of term limits in any kind of vocal way. When they were put on the ballot in Michigan in 1992, they were really being targeted more at Washington. We've seen Washington go through many changes without term limits now in terms of who leads and who's minority, who's majority. But term limits around the country were imposed on lots of state legislative bodies, and I think much to the detriment of most of those bodies now. And part of it's just structurally they're wrong. If you want to limit the total amount of time somebody serves, that's one question. But the limits that are so precise, only 6 years in the House of Representatives, means that before someone can understand the transportation formula or the criminal justice system or the Medicaid funding, they're gone. Those are complex systems, interaction between federal and state, in many cases local governmental levels. We just don't find very many people getting elected with the expertise that one would have if you served a dozen years. And so maybe the future says, well, you can serve today, you can serve 6 years in the House, 8 years in the Senate. Maybe it's 14 total or 16 total, and you could divide it up however you wanted. Then both chambers would probably end up with some senior members who would have some experience that could help the younger members. The other consequence of the term limits has been that people say, well, I'm only going to be there for a little bit of time. I'll bring my buddy with me. That person then works for them. So you've got two people who don't know anything. And it just hasn't worked the way I think it intended and the way reform-minded people hoped it would. There was also a sense it was going to make people who served, people who got elected, very independent. It's actually made them very timid because they don't like to take chances now. They just got there. They don't know that they can take chances and be courageous and make hard decisions, so they don't. They shy away from us.
You think it's time that the Michigan leaders got together and made an effort at changing it?
Well, it's time the Michigan people decided it needed to be changed. I think the leaders would all support it, but the people have to understand that it makes sense, and I'm not sure they're there yet. But I do believe there's bipartisan support among people who are in places like universities or other organizations who work with government, road builders, or and say, look, we really need some people with some expertise back here, because you're talking about multi-billions of dollars being spent each year, and you have an appropriation chair who arrived there 5 minutes ago, maybe in some cases, or maybe just a year and a half ago, and now they're becoming. You have people arriving in Lansing who want to be the Speaker of the House. They've never even been to a committee meeting. Mm-hmm. And so that just doesn't work very well. And I think about some of the people that I served with who I leaned on even as governor. They were still in the legislature. It just, you just can't get that expertise anymore. And that's too bad, because I think that works against Michigan. It probably makes the governor, if they're able to put together the right team and have the right agenda, maybe makes them a bit stronger. I'm not sure. It sure probably makes the lobbying community stronger than they've ever been, because they're able to go and persuade people you don't want to take these risks, So it's a powerful defense of the status quo at a time when people are saying with ever louder voices, I want change.
Thinking about sort of the term of conservative, You were considered conservative when you were elected. You were considered conservative when you were the leader of the state Senate. Do you think you still fit that definition today of conservative from the view of kind of the rank-and-file Republicans?
Well, I think if by that you mean having government play a smaller, not larger role in people's lives, have government balance its books, have government do for folks or help people do what they can't do on their own. Building roads might be a good example of that. Running schools might be another. I'm not somebody who believes there can't be a government. I do think we have a strain of almost libertarianism that's, you know, sometimes described as conservative that would go that far. I don't go and never did go that far. At the same time, I was always what I thought was a reform-minded conservative, because I don't think a conservative means you do nothing until you're no longer in the majority. Then I guess if you're not conservative, maybe you're if the opposite of that is liberal, then the conservative doesn't do much to help their cause. If they do nothing until they're not in power, then the liberals take power and they start moving it down, and then they, however far they go, it stops when the conservatives come back. You need the competition of ideas, and I was always anxious and eager to get into that kind of debate about what's the best approach. How do you make things work, and how do you make them work better? I mean, it's embarrassing when you have 5% of the kids in the Detroit public schools, in the traditional public schools, able to be deemed proficient on the National Education Report Card for reading. So a classroom of 21 child can read proficiently? That's what the data shows. No one in Michigan, black, white, Republican, Democrat, conservative, liberal, can look in the mirror and say, that's a good result. That just is outrageous. And that's the one thing that, you know, and I think there are other things like that that we ought to be able to say, hey, we can do better. We had a lot of celebrating back in the 1990s when we had counties, entire counties, where everyone who was on public assistance was working. You know, they may not have been working a lot of hours. Maybe in some cases they were working and it was a volunteer kind of role, but they were getting experience, getting back in the workforce, setting an example for not only their families, but also just, you know, the community at large. That's the kind of stuff. How do we get everybody trained to have a job today? You know, so there's enough problems to be worked on, and people can say, well, I would do it this way or that way, and maybe that's more conservative, more liberal. But the question is, are you going to fix the problem or not? That's what we ought to be worried about.
Your tenure as governor, what do you think you're going to be remembered most for?
Well, I don't know. I mean, that's, you know, I think the things that today continue to stand somewhat the test of time of the reforms we made in the way we fund education. We certainly didn't solve all the problems in terms of delivering for every child a quality education, but we've set in place the fundamentals now that I think that the competition clearly has led to some really excellent outcomes. And while there's a big debate, I saw a candidate for the Democratic nomination who wanted to, you know, inexplicably wants to take on one kind of school but not the other. You know, a bad school is a bad school. A school that's not working is a school that's not working, whether it's a private school, a public school, or a combination thereof. And what the problem is the child is not educated regardless of where they went to school. It's going to be a problem later on, and they're going to have a problem in terms of their own aspirations and what they can do for themselves and their family and for the society at large. So education is a top priority. You know, infrastructure remains a big problem. We've slipped as a nation. I think one of the things that I'm excited about with this new administration is I think they're serious about looking at very creative strategies to get America rebuilt again. We do that, we're going to have, along with that, the largest job training program we've ever seen in the country, because we no longer have, in many cases, the skilled workers ready to go do that work. Mm-hmm. So that's a huge and urgent need. And states ought to be thinking, how do I get ready so that if there is a strategy to deal with infrastructure, I've got a workforce that's ready to go work quickly, because I have a sense that whoever's ready to go quick might have more funds than somebody who's not.
Mm-hmm. What do you think Governor Rick Snyder's tenure will be remembered for?
You know, it's not even over yet, so a little unfair to, you know, I think that he ought to have an opportunity to leave and look back on two terms. Clearly, though, one thing that's already been quite evident is that he had an opportunity, and in some ways it was even tougher, I think, than the job I had. I had a big fiscal problem to deal with when I took office. But we weren't as quite as down as we were when Governor Snyder came into office. I think he found a state that was in a almost severe state of depression. And he really has brought back, I think, a can-do attitude again. So I think that's going to be awfully important, because there's those 8 missing years between when I left and when Governor Snyder arrived. And he really has brought things back. He brought a sense of energy. And it was interesting. There had not been, in 25 years before I became governor, a single month where the unemployment rate had been below the national average. And then we went 8 years after I left, never got unemployment below the national average, and Governor Snyder got back to that point. And we had quite a few months, but I mean, he got us back to that point. That's something that does stand the test of time, no matter what else. I think there's a lot of other things he's going to look at. Clearly, he's going to look back at Flint and not like to think about that very much, but there's no question that there's some good economic news that he's going to be able to take some pride in.
One final question, we'll let you go here. I want to talk real briefly about the role of taxes in a state's development and the competitiveness of taxes. How do you think Michigan sits today?
I have not been studying state-by-state comparisons of late. I know that Michigan has had job growth that is much more rapid than we were experiencing, so that's a tribute. There's no question that taxes matter. Services matter. Increasingly, the thing that's going to matter most is workforce, because if you don't have trained workers, no one will be able to grow and expand if they're in the state, and no one will be attracted to come there if they're not in the state. So that's going to be important. Now, interestingly, largely we're funding that. That's not underfunded in so many ways. I mean, there are always people who say, well, I'd like more money. Of course they would. Everybody would like more money, whether you're a family and your family budget, or you're a program or an agency depending on a government supplied budget. You'd love to have more money. But I think the total picture is going to be one where you've got to be competitive on your taxes. I mean, you've seen states get in, and I think Kansas was one where, while the governor out there survived a close election, they almost went so far as to get themselves into a budgetary problem, and I don't think you want to do that. And the states know this. I mean, the federal government forgets it, we think, at times, but you know, they can print money, states can't, and so you do have to keep that budget balanced. And the trick is to have enough growth so you can have some expansion in the things that are priorities without having to burden your citizens more. And we found that we had a situation where we had to bring taxes down, and we had to, it was important to bring it down on small business. It was important to limit, and in our case, it was the property tax back in the 90s that had been for at least a couple of decades a major irritant to people. People have completely forgotten that Detroit was almost a 60 mills for property tax burden supporting education. Think of all those houses and apartments that are being built in Detroit. Had that continued, none of that could happen. It was simply impossible. We literally had years where there were no building permits in Detroit for residential housing. So it's a balance that has to be in one's approach, and I think that's very key to keep in mind. And people say, well, I'd love to have $2 more in terms of a tax reduction, and that might get you won't even get you a Starbucks coffee, get a regular cup of coffee somewhere, I guess. But if the effect of that is then that I'm driving on roads and destroying my car, that's probably not going to be, at the end of the day, making people very happy. Mm-hmm. If the coffee's bouncing out of their cup because the road's so bad, they're not going to be happy about having an extra cup of coffee. Anyway, I think the best governors out there are striking the right balance. You saw in Connecticut recently, the governor announced he's not going to run for re-election. There's a case where it happens to be a Democrat governor, but went way, way too far on the tax hike side, made the state competitive and literally drove out both businesses and high-income individuals who might have played a role in helping that state, which used to be considered the competitive state in the Northeast, maintain its some forward momentum. It's now one of the most non-productive states that we've got in the Union.
Okay. Well, thank you again, Governor. We appreciate you taking time.
Okay, very good.
That's going to do it for this week's edition of the MERS Monday podcast. Thanks to the crew here, Jack, John, Jacob, Simon, and Mike, and also the governor for taking some time with us today. I wanted to give a special thanks to Simon for introducing us to the world of Indian food last week. It was his birthday, and for his birthday meal, he suggested food. I had no idea what the heck it was. I just asked him to order me something. And for those interested, I did get that red stain of whatever that was that I ate off my shirt. So I was very excited about that. What was that again that you ordered me?
You ordered a chicken tikka masala. It's a very popular Indian
dish. Say it again, though.
Chicken tikka masala.
Tikka masala?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
We should note that Kyle said introduce us to Indian food, but I think he meant Kyle was introduced to Indian food.
John, how many times you had Indian food, John?
Lots.
What? Mike, was that your...
That was my second time eating Indian food.
Okay, well, thank you. And you're a little older than me. Okay, so I don't feel so bad anymore. What, do you have it every Saturday or something?
I just want to clarify that you were the one that was the kind of the newbie on this, which is an exciting thing. It's exciting to have new food, but it was nice to be reintroduced to Indian food. It's been a while for me.
Well, okay. Well, it was a good experience to me. Jack, how many times you had Indian food?
Not a lot. I'm on a restricted diet, so I just don't want to curry favor with anybody.
Oh. All right. Well, we're going to close on that bad pun. Until next week, I'm Connor Moore. Take care.